video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here it's your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic, and today we're going to be speaking to James Corbett of The Corbett Report. If people don't know about his good show, help promote it, and then talk about one of the topics that he was did a really good job on describing, which was 9/11. So, Mr. Corbett, thank you for taking time for Black Op Radio.
No problem, Len. It's good to be back on. It's been a couple years, but happy to be here to catch up.
Yeah, I follow some of the videos you've done. The most notable one, which was quite famous, was the 9/11 Explained in 5 Minutes. And that went viral, as they say. And I was so happy to hear it was you, and I check on your site. As I mentioned, I just signed up again. I guess I'd let my subscription drop off, and so it's very reasonable. And thecorbettreport.com, if anybody's listening, log in there. Check out audio, video. There's a newsletter once you sign up and things like that. How long have you been doing The Corbett Report?
So I started in 2007, so that makes it the 17th year this year that I've been doing this. But I've been doing it full time as my real deal, honest to God job for the last 13 years.
Well, congratulations. You know, you're one of the few shows that no one has a bad word to say about. It's just you've got a lot of respect from everywhere. And as a matter of fact, you were just featured on Jimmy Dore show about a month ago. And I was refreshing, you know, I like stuff that you've been doing, so I was glad. I said, oh, he's on there. Do you want to tell me, listeners, anything about that one?
I was surprised to get contacted by his producer out of the blue, and they wanted to have me on. And of course, what did he react to is that 9/11 in 5 minutes video that you talked about, which has certainly taken on a life of its own over the years. In fact, its original title is 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory, but it's been posted and reposted so many times on so many channels by so many people under so many different titles. I think everyone knows it a little bit differently. But that's definitely, of all the things I've ever done, that's the one that went the most viral. And I've even had people, just friends, casual acquaintances I know here in Japan, saying, hey, I saw this thing on Facebook the other week. Was that you? Yep, that was me.
Yeah, it's refreshing because it's almost written by a comedian saying, like, you wouldn't believe, like a George Carlin, you know, you wouldn't believe this, you wouldn't believe that. And yet, item after item, you just get slapped in the face with it's in the same style that much of your other, I've seen other videos where you have that kind of style as well. But that one was so quick and to the point, it pokes a hole in the thing. And as a Canadian, I still can't believe that Americans just let the thing slide. I mean, they just somehow go, well, maybe the government's not telling the truth. And since it's the anniversary and early September here, this will be the 11th or 12th by the time this airs. I just like to give you a chance to just, you know, to talk to me about it, but listeners too, about the fact that somehow they got away with this. And if any item you look into, it just slaps you in the face. Well, this is a fraud, but what are you going to do?
That's exactly right. And so people who are interested in this, they can go to CorbettReport.com/911conspiracy and watch that 5 minute video. And as you say, it puts it in a slightly humorous way, isn't it? It does come across as funny, the absolute ridiculous nature of this story that they want us to believe. And all I do is say the official story that they want us to believe in all of its various aspects. But I put it together in the way that they don't want you to think about it, that the essentially making it into a ridiculous story. And this actually revolves around one of the themes I keep going back to with my work on 9/11 specifically, and a lot of other work besides, is that fundamentally the war of terror that resulted from that that justification, or that false justification of 9/11, is a story. It's a narrative that has been put before the public, and that the public believed for at least long enough. I think we're probably finally coming out of the shadow of the hysteria that 9/11 caused, but it certainly served its purpose when it comes to Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, all of the other ridiculous things that have happened. Heartbreaking things, really, when you look at all the countless victims of 9/11, not just those that died on the day, but those that died in the wars that were justified on the back of that pretense. And I think probably the most important thing to drill into the head of the average person who has never once thought about 9/11 or 9/11 truth, or doesn't really care about it, the number one most important thing to bring to their attention is that that story, the story of 9/11 that has been crafted and brought to you by the official sources and the 9/11 Commission, etc., was crafted and constructed based on torture testimony, testimony extracted through torture that we know and can documentably, verifiably show is false. For example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11 from A to Z, as the American media portrayed him in the wake of his arrest and detainment at Guantanamo Bay, has, for example, confessed to plotting to blow up buildings that didn't even exist at the time when he was a free man, before he got taken to Guantanamo. So we know that the torture, we've known for a very long time, that torture only ever extracts what the torturers want to hear and does not extract the truth. And that's exactly what we get in this case. So no matter what you believe about what did or didn't happen on 9/11, we know that the official story, the official narrative that has been crafted for us, is exactly as believable as, say, the Saddam Hussein weapons of mass destruction lie, which is to say, not believable at all. We know that that is not the truth. Now, what is the actual truth is a much more difficult question, but we can definitely point to all the parts of the story that deconstruct themselves and laugh at them.
Well, laugh at them. I think it's even darker than that, because I think that if they had planned this adventure of taking money out of the American taxpayer, they manufactured the whole thing, and it's like planting weeds and then watering them, and then what you humorously could call enhanced interrogation, right? They just put stuff together to fit that they got to have a bad guy, they got to have a boogeyman somewhere, so we'll find him and we'll blame Osama bin Laden.
You know, in fact, speaking of that very point, and speaking of the idea of narrative construction around these events, it's almost, unfortunately, to our detriment that one of the best articulations of this idea came in a completely fictional TV series that aired several months before 9/11, a.k.a. the pilot episode of The Lone Gunman. And that is something that I play clips of in my 9/11 War Games documentary. That, again, like all my work, is available for free, corbettreport.com/911wargames. And in that, I play some clips from that episode, which, again, aired several months before 9/11, about terrorists that were going to hijack a jumbo jet and fly it into the World Trade Center in order to, well, for what exactly? Well, as eventually they uncover, well, it's not just terrorists, it's actually people within the government, within the military, who are doing this in order to essentially gin up war in the Middle East as a way to keep the money flowing to the military-industrial complex in the wake of the end of the Cold War. And essentially, I mean, that is an important part of what we see unfolding on 9/11 in many of its key respects, including, of course, the remote control ? Hijacking of a jumbo jet or numerous jumbo jets in order to hit the World Trade Center, in order to gin up war in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost eerie how those sorts of things line up. And unfortunately, again, it works to our detriment, because you bring that up and, of course, people will roll their eyes as if, oh, well, do you think Chris Carter and the X-Files were really behind all of this? Well, of course not. But it at the very least, it does present the articulation of exactly what we're talking about here. It is demonstrable in the wake of the end of the Cold War, in this 1990s period of the peace dividends that we were going to reap from finally having ended the Cold War and, oh, we can start reducing the military. Well, there are interests that were identified by that crazy wild-eyed conspiracy theorist, Dwight Eisenhower, on his way out of the presidential office back in 1961, who warned us, of course, about the military-industrial complex and its machinations. And they obviously were not happy about declining budgets, etc., which gives at least one motivation for the events that happened on 9/11. Now, to be clear, I do not think that a large-scale event like a JFK assassination, like a 9/11, happens for one singular reason, committed by one singular group. I think these types of mammoth deep state events, deep political events, take place because a number of different interests converge on this thing happening. But that is certainly one plausible motivation for some of the people that were involved, which of course raises the question, well, then what are you saying? Do you think the military itself was actually involved in what was happening on 9/11? Well, again, exactly, unfortunately, again, exactly like they say in the Lone Pilot, Lone Gunman Pilot episode that I talk about, there you go again, blaming the entire government. But it's, in fact, a small faction. Well, I think there certainly were demonstrably people involved in the chain of command on 9/11 that were involved in the response to those events and complicating and hindering the response to those events. And for that, if people are interested, again, I would recommend my 9/11 War Games documentary, because we think of 9/11 as just a usual regular day of aviation, but it was anything but. There were literally, identifiably, at least 24 different exercises, drills, simulations, and various types of exercises that were being prepared and either taking place directly on 9/11 or around 9/11 that directly impacted the response, the government response to those events. For example, just as one example, Vigilant Guardian, which is a massive NORAD exercise, wargaming various events that could take place over American airspace, including terrorists hijacking aircraft and flying them into New York, was one of the things that were being envisioned in that war game, which was injecting fake radar blips onto NORAD's screens as part of this war game simulation exercise, which demonstrably caused confusion on the morning of 9/11 when actual planes that we are told were actually hijacked by actual hijackers were actually flying into New York and caused massive confusion with people who repeatedly throughout the morning, as we can hear on the tapes that were eventually let out of NORAD's response, repeatedly the question asked over and over, is this real or is this exercise? And there was repeated confusion about those radar blips and which ones were real and which ones were not, including quote-unquote phantom Flight 11, Flight 11 having hit the World Trade Center, but having been identified by NORAD as continuing to be in the air heading towards Washington for up to 10 or 15 minutes after it had actually hit the World Trade Center. So there was a lot of craziness going on that morning that cannot be easily explained by the fact that this was a terrorist attack directed by a man on dialysis in a cave halfway around the world who somehow knew the exact perfect day of massive confusion on the American Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, the whole thing is, you know, if it was like a movie script, you might say, well, no one will ever buy it. You know, you can't. They'll storm the White House. They'll demand answers. They'll ask that someone be fired. I mean, when it got to the point when Bush was going to be asked to testify, he said, well, I'm not going alone. I'm going to bring Cheney with me then, and it won't be on the record. And just that in itself, you'd say, well, what kind of fraud is this from my point of view?
Absolutely. No, exactly right. Yes, the off-the-record testimony of Cheney and Bush, who had to testify together, by the way, the presumption there being that Cheney, essentially, as we know, was really the one that was directing the Bush White House. Bush was in charge nominally, but perhaps not in reality. And in order to make sure that their stories meshed, they had to testify together, but not testify in some sort of open recorded testimony. No, off the record. Only notes were allowed. And those notes were finally released 20 plus years later. But we know that those notes have been heavily doctored and manipulated by Philip Zelikow and the others in the 9/11 Commission.
Oh, so, well, you mentioned his name and then just all bets are off. It's just
exactly right. But I just want on one more thing on that Hollywood note of what we saw unfolding on that day. That isn't just sort of an analogy. that really gets something to the heart of these types of events, because regardless, again, whether you believe the official narrative of 9/11 100% or 0% or something in between, the explicit aim and function of a massive terrorist event like that is to function in something like a dramatic Hollywood fashion that will garner people's attention. That is the explicit aim of avowed terrorists, whether those terrorists be turban-wearing boogeymen on the other side of the planet or people within the NATO, NORAD complex, whatever. At any rate, that is part of what this is attempting to do, is to be a spectacular event that captures people's attention and imagination. And on that note, I would direct people to an incredibly well-researched, very good article by the late, great Graeme McQueen, Professor Graeme McQueen, who wrote about the Pentagon's B-movie, looking closely at the September 2001 attacks, talking about the Hollywood aspects of what was happening on 9/11 and some of the Hollywood connections, in fact, to the Pentagon itself.
They had a catchphrase for this when you look into their project for New American Century, right?
The New Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, we need a new Pearl Harbor event.
Yes, so for people who don't know, the reference on that is to a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses that was put out by an organization called the Project for a New American Century that was founded in 1997 by a bunch of neocons, the very same neocons who later went on to populate the Bush administration. And back in 1997, they were forming essentially to lobby then-President Clinton to get into war with Iraq. And why on earth should the U.S. should be getting so excited and interested in a war on Iraq in the late 1990s? Well, that goes back to a document that was written for the Israeli government, in fact, submitted to now Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by, again, a couple of neocons who went on to populate the Bush administration, called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Protecting the Realm, or I can't remember the exact subhead, but something along those lines. And in that Clean Break document, they talk about, for in the interest of Israeli foreign policy goals, we need to make sure that Saddam Hussein gets toppled in Iraq. And in the late 1990s, the Project for New American Century went on to lobby for that. In the year 2000, they produced this document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, that was all about how do we continue to project U.S. unipolar military might into the 21st century. Well, it's going to take this massive transformation and all of this investment of resources and etc. But exactly as we were just talking about, well, this is the 1990s, the Cold War is over, there's no big boogeyman, what are you going to do? In that document, they specifically said this process of transformation will not take place without a catastrophic, catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And it's interesting in that context to look, for example, at the Senate confirmation hearings of Rumsfeld back in January of 2001, when he was being confirmed for his defense secretary role in the Bush administration, where he brought up repeatedly Pearl Harbor and talked about having recently read a book about Pearl Harbor and the way that it transformed the American mindset, etc. This was definitely something that the neocons were trying to seed into the public imagination beforehand. And yet another interesting linkage. Of course, we saw the Pearl Harbor movie coming out in September 2001, just to freshly remind the public. Thankfully, it turned out to be such a horrible movie that most people immediately ignored it. But it was another attempt, I think, to seed that into the public consciousness. And lo and behold, the Pearl Harbor arrived on September 11th, 2001. And as a result of that, well, we saw what happened. For example, we now know from the notes that have come out that Donald Rumsfeld was taking on the day of 9/11 in meetings, or people were taking notes, people were taking in meetings with Donald Rumsfeld on the evening of 9/11. They were already looking for ways to pin this on Saddam. And the note said that Donald Rumsfeld's order was to scoop up all information, relevant or not. I can't remember the exact phrase that he used, but you can actually see those notes that were being taken. They were already within hours of the events of 9/11 looking for a way to pin it on Saddam Hussein and link it to Iraq, because of course that was the foreign policy goal of the neocons.
And in spite of later on the discovery that 17 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabian.
So. Not only that, yes, of course, yes, the Saudi connection and what was going on with regards to that, but also another fascinating and much neglected aspect of that story of those those hijackers and what, who they were and where they were coming from, is given by J. Michael Springman, who was a consular officer working at the Jeddah consulate in Saudi Arabia in the late 1980s. And he testified at that time, of course, during the time of the Afghan war, the Soviet-Afghan war, in which the Soviets were embroiled and enmeshed in an ongoing conflict against not only the Taliban, but of course, what eventually went on to become Al-Qaeda, the so-called Arab Afghans, led by people like Osama bin Laden. He was testifying that at that Jeddah consulate, they were repeatedly getting requests for green cards or permission to enter the United States from candidates who were not qualified in any way to receive such entry into the United States. So he would reject these people and their application, and that rejection would be repeatedly overturned by the higher-ups in that consular office, who he, of course, later learned were CIA. And when he got back to the United States after serving his time there in the late 1980s, he discovered from Joseph Trento, the journalist in Washington, what that was an operation to send people from Afghanistan to the United States for military training. What people? Well, specifically Osama bin Laden, who was at that time a golden boy who was working actively and collaborating with the CIA. He was getting his soldiers essentially trained in the U.S. And it was exactly that same consular office in Jeddah that issued, and I can never quite remember the exact number. I believe it was certainly over 12 of those 17 Saudis, let alone the 19 hijackers, had their passports issued at that Jeddah consulate in particular, the one that we know CIA officers were approving people who did not meet basic application requirements for entry to the U.S., precisely because they worked with Osama bin Laden. That, again, is just such an incredible story that has been completely neglected by the mainstream media.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm sitting here listening to you, I just realize how knowledgeable you are about the topic. And, you know, we could talk about even Sybil Edmonds, that there's a translator, right? And she came across all sorts of wires that were talking about these operations are going on, and just she's been shut up and ghosted. And there's several people like that. That came out to talk about something and then you just never hear from them again.
I did a documentary on 9/11 whistleblowers where I talked not only about J. Michael Springman, but other people who had some form of inside knowledge or at any rate came into the 9/11 story and were soundly rejected, shunned from their business or their contacts, etc., for having come out about it. For example, someone like Kevin Ryan, who was working at Underwriters Laboratories, which of course is the same UL that was underwriting the steel that was used in the construction of the World Trade Center. And as a result of that, they had to come out with their own report about what happened at the World Trade Center. And Kevin Ryan, being on the inside of Underwriters Laboratory, saw the deep discrepancies and problems with the types of things that UL was doing to say that, oh, well, for some reason or other, this steel, which had been certified, which was fireproofed, which had absolutely never before and never since just fallen completely and utterly collapsed and pulverized into dust, this however many thousands of tons of steel, never happened before, never happened since. And Underwriters Laboratory was fine with this because it lasted an hour. What is happening here? When he started to raise questions about that, of course, immediately rejected and ultimately cast out of Underwriters Laboratory. People like the janitor at the World Trade Center, or one of the janitors who had the so-called golden key, the key of life, as it became known, because he had access to essentially any elevator shaft, any stairwell, what have you. And he was able to save multiple people that day, ultimately awarded, even given a Medal of Honor by President Bush himself for being one of the heroes of 9/11, saving multiple people that day. He testified there was an explosion in the basement of the World Trade Center where he was when the attacks were happening before the first plane hit the World Trade Center. And he testifies about someone who came out of the elevator after this explosion, skin hanging off him completely and utterly torn to shreds. And that is when the plane ultimately struck. So he had deep, deep questions about what was happening in the basement and what was happening elsewhere in the building that, again, were completely ignored. People like Barry Jennings, who was working for the Office of Emergency Management at the in New York. And that day he was reporting to the Office of Emergency Management, which Mayor Giuliani, back when he was mayor of New York, had very controversially located inside World Trade Center Building 7, despite the fact that, of course, in 1993, there had already been a major terror attack at the World Trade Center complex. Many people were saying, if there is ever going to be another major terror event, it's probably going to happen in the World Trade Center complex. Why are you putting the Office of Emergency Management there? Anyway, that's where it was on, I believe, the 26th floor of Building 7. When Barry Jennings and Corporation Counsel Michael Hess were heading into the Office of Emergency Management that morning on 9/11, after having seen about the attacks, they discovered the entire office had been abandoned because, as Mayor Giuliani later told ABC News, well, we were told that the buildings were coming down. So we evacuated and we got out and started staging elsewhere outside of the World Trade Center grounds, which is an interesting thing that no one's ever followed up on except a few independent reporters. But also when Barry Jennings and Michael Hess were making their way out of the building, coming down the stairwell because the elevators had stopped functioning by that point, they testified there was a massive explosion within World Trade Center Building 7 that essentially blew them up the stairs, and which blocked their path so that they were trapped inside Building 7 for a couple of hours until they were rescued by first responders. And of course, that goes against what we are told about what happened at Building 7. Barry Jennings was adamant, absolutely adamant. No, this was not the plane hitting the building or some, you know, debris raining down from the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers. No, this was from within the building. But of course, that isn't the official story about what happened to Building 7, which, hey, there's always new people who's tuning into this information. For anyone who doesn't know, yes, Building 7, the third building to fall on 9/11, which unfortunately, still, there are people who don't know about, which was not hit by a plane, and yet, like the Twin Towers, spontaneously collapsed into its own footprint, at least for some significant portion of that fall, at free fall gravitational acceleration. If you dropped a ball from the top, from the roof of World Trade Center 7, the building was falling at that rate, at least for several seconds of its descent, which is absolutely impossible unless every single main structural connection was cut at the exact same moment. But we are asked to believe that there was a failure on a single beam because of hot fires that were supposedly raging in Building 7 that day that somehow caused the complete and total collapse of this 47-story building that had not been struck by a plane. I could go on, but I think that might give an example of some of the people who have testified.
Well, I'm going to make links to your 9/11 page because I've seen a few of those videos, and I have a question for you, but I'm just going to preface it here with a statement that early in the game, I interviewed Peter Joseph that did Zeitgeist, and his three-part series was on money, religion, and 9/11. And when I asked him what made him start, what was a catalyst, he said that he just really couldn't believe that the American public were going along with this. So saying that, my question to you is, do you have any insight or reasons why you think maybe that it just hasn't resonated, that people still trust the government?
Well, I can speak from my own experience and how I came into this, because for the first 5 years after 9/11, I personally would not countenance any conspiracy talk around this. And I have been someone who pretty much throughout my life, as long as I've been a coherent and responsible adult, I've always understood that things are not necessarily always as reported. And for example, I never in my entire life really believed that Oswald was the lone nut, etc. But I, when it came to 9/11, I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. It's disrespectful, etc. All of the walls that have been erected in the minds of the average person against questioning the events of 9/11, I certainly adhered to that for the first 5 years. It wasn't until around the fifth anniversary of 9/11, and I didn't understand what was happening at the time. I do now in retrospect, because of the fifth anniversary and the various events, including protests and other things that were taking place. People might not remember there was a symposium that was held in New York in 2006 around the events, around the time of the fifth anniversary, that was actually broadcast on C-SPAN, featuring various researchers questioning the events of that day. So it was making some headwaves and finally filtering into the public consciousness. And as a result, I was sitting here in Japan on YouTube, which was a new, quote unquote, new website at the time, and seeing these recommended videos about various 9/11 conspiracy topics. And eventually, although some of them really were ridiculous and eye-rolling, some of them brought up little nuggets of information that were so crazy to me, so counter to what I had believed, that I had to go and verify that information for myself. And I can't remember exactly every single thing that I saw, but I do remember, for example, learning about Operation Northwoods and thinking, well, that cannot be true. That's got to be. And then I would go to the National Security Archive and look at the PDF of the actual document of Operation Northwoods and read it for myself. And it was things like that that started to pierce that shield that had been erected in my mind around this topic. And I cannot speak to why some people are not able to do that. I could certainly understand if people had direct personal loss of a family member or something, that they may be more sensitive to this subject and may feel that it is disrespectful to their loved one to question the official narrative. But still, there are those who have that type of direct personal loss who find it disrespectful not to question what is going on, to not find out the truth about what happened.
I hate to interrupt you, but on that point, it almost seems to me that the opposite is true, that wives and sons and daughters of people who died that day really were demanding more answers, and they were really turned down at every opportunity. You know, I think they felt slighted by the government that they really didn't investigate it.
There was an excellent early 9/11 truth, or at least 9/11 truth adjacent documentary called 9/11 Press for Truth, which was about the Jersey widows, the collection of wives who pressed, who ultimately got the 9/11 commission greenlighted in the first place, because the Bush administration had actively for 18 months tried to avoid appointing commission. They finally had to appoint a commission because of the pressure from these widows and the various family members who had their questions about what happened in 9/11. Of course, infamously, Bush first attempted to appoint Kissinger to head that commission, but even
Henry
the New York
Kissinger.
Times, exactly. Even the New York Times said, well, that's clearly a cover-up. It's going to be a cover-up commission. So the story goes that the Jersey widows had a meeting with Henry Kissinger prior to his accepting this appointment. And they asked him if he had any clients of his Kissinger and Associates consulting group by the name of, say, Bin Laden. At which point, they testify, he almost fell out of his chair from having received that question, of course, refused to answer the question, and the next day declined the post as head of the commission. So they appointed Philip Zelikow, who I have talked about in my 9/11 suspect series, if people want to know more about that. But yes, clearly, the questioning of the family members was an important point in getting literally anything out of the government, even the cover-up torture testimony-derived 9/11 commission report, for whatever that's worth. In recent years, the widows, wives, et cetera, have been pursuing, for example, lawsuits against the Saudi Arabian government for its links to whatever happened on 9/11. And there has been some movement on that people have probably seen in the mainstream media about the 28 pages, et cetera. And we can get into that. But I feel that is to some extent a limited hangout, but certainly there was some degree of Saudi participation in the 9/11 plot. And one of the most interesting parts is that the filmmakers behind that 9/11 Press for Truth documentary by the name of Duffy and Novoselsky, several years later, they scored an interview with Richard Clark, who was the counterterror czar under Clinton and then under Bush, around the time of 9/11, the counterterror czar at the time of 9/11, who... they were not expecting this during their interview, but he just casually and offhandedly brought up the idea that he thought that two of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar, were being run by the CIA in what he called a false flag operation to try to turn those Al-Qaeda members, and they were being actively protected by the CIA through their Saudi cutouts, Saudi intelligence cutouts in the United States prior to 9/11. And that's a pretty amazingly bombshell sort of thing for the former counter-terrorist czar to casually admit to the documentary cameras of Duffy and Novoselsky, but he did. And I ask you, how many people in the audience have probably even heard of this story, because it received almost zero attention in the mainstream media? But that seems like some sort of cookie crumb trail that people might want to at least investigate the existence of.
Yeah, among so many other things that where they took their flight training, were they dating strippers, did they drink? I mean, you get into some of these things and you go, no way. The whole thing. I mean, even when you were saying the new Pearl Harbor, I started thinking, I bet you people don't really realize there's a backside to Pearl Harbor. That they knew that was coming.
Right. Yes. Right.
And so they just said, oh, great. Let's get all our dilapidated ships all in there and give them something to shoot at. And then it's a day of infamy. We had no idea it was coming. And our aircraft carriers were out of the harbor miraculously, Anyway, the any angle you look at, the fraud is so deep in this. I still have trouble trying to figure out why Americans aren't standing in front of the White House with torches and pitchforks, but they're not. And Cheney, they're asking Cheney, the latest thing was he is going to endorse Kamala.
And I don't know in what universe Democrats are living that is somehow some sort of endorsement that they want to hype. But here we are in the year 2024. Actually, I think that shows part of what the reason for people not being out on the streets protesting and being upset about this is. For the first 10 to 15 years, I think that, as I say, the shields and the walls that people put up in their own minds around this subject was enough to keep most people away from it. That's crazy conspiracy talk. Don't even bring that up. It's disrespectful. Now that we have enough distance from the events that people can actually start to question them, I think most people... The pressing political nature of 9/11 and its undoubted connection to so many different things that we've lived through over the past couple of decades, that's starting to wane. In 2024, it's no longer war of terror, 9/11. That was, of course, the joke. I believe Family Guy and others made that joke, that basically any politician that just got up and said 9/11 back in the early noughts would just receive standing ovations and people would go crazy and it was wonderful. And yes, 9/11, let's never forget. Now, I think, mission accomplished. I think people have forgotten, essentially, 9/11, at least in terms of its actual political significance. And unfortunately, like the JFK investigation, after 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, the pressing political reality of what took place and the incredible importance of getting this right for the historical record, that starts to dwindle in a lot of people's minds. Well, that was 50 years ago. All those people are dead. Who cares? And unfortunately, I think we're arriving at that point with 9/11, that people are willing, for example, to court the endorsement of someone like a Cheney and hold that up as something to be revered instead of something absolutely detestable from one of the most disgusting war criminals of our lifetime.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember this quote on one of the Borat movies. He's there giving a speech and he goes, "We support you on your war of terror."
Yes. In fact, I think that's probably where that phrase was first seeded into my imagination. War of terror.
Did he say no? Oh, yeah. But anyway, it's just that's great humor there.
Yeah.
And the fact that people are looking to Cheney for anything that he's not. I mean, I think the thing with Henry Kissinger too is that he could be arrested. If he went to some other countries, they would have an arrest warrant out for him,
There was also the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal that was held about a decade ago that did find Bush and various members of his administration guilty of war crimes, crimes against humanity. Now, this is not a tribunal that had any political international civil law teeth to it. But it was, for example, supported by the ex-prime minister of Malaysia, etc. So a pretty amazing thing. But again, who's even heard about it? And which country would be willing to enforce something like that and actually arrest someone? There was talk of Bush arresting Bush or and or Cheney when, for example, when they were traveling to Canada back in the early part of the last decade, etc. But of course, that amounted to very little, unfortunately.
Yeah, to nothing. So, and I live in Vancouver, yeah. Canada, and I was pissed off. Yeah. And there were people went out to see him, and it was just like, are you kidding me? You know, I couldn't believe that either. You know, it's like. Yeah. People paying Hillary Clinton to speak and they'll show up. I mean, it's just
Yes. But if people want more on Cheney and his potential connections, again, I've talked about this in many different works that I've done. For example, one of them that people should be looking at is just the on its face, blatant, ridiculous conflict of interest in Dick Cheney going from the Secretary of Defense in the first Bush regime, where he appointed a Halliburton subsidiary to work on as a contractor to work on the question of whether the Pentagon should be hiring and giving more money to contractors for military work. Surprisingly enough, they said, yes, the Pentagon should be paying companies like us more money. And then he left, of course, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, to become the CEO of Halliburton. And after spending some time there, he then, of course, became vice president under Bush Jr., at which point he was giving all of these no-bid contracts to Halliburton in the wake of the Iraq/Afghanistan destruction. So just blatant things like that, but also more interesting aspects of deep politics. Peter Dale Scott and others have talked about continuity of government planning, that Rumsfeld and Cheney specifically were involved from the time of, I believe, President Ford and from around that era. In the 1970s and early 1980s, working on continuity of government planning for the United States that was implemented on 9/11, which, again, seems like an interesting field of research that has been largely neglected. And then there's the questions that, for example, one of the original 9/11 investigators, Michael Rupert, raised with regards to Dick Cheney and what he was doing in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the PEOC, under the White House on the morning of 9/11, where it is Michael Rupert's assertion that Cheney was running the PTEC software, which is an entire other rabbit hole that we could go into. But long story short, there was a highly suspicious company with all of these crazy connections that you will not believe until you actually see a report on it. And I have done several over the years. But this crazily terrorist connected company had essentially back doors into every major sensitive system of the U.S. government, including the Department of Defense and including the FAA. And they were working on the contract that was investigating interoperability of FAA systems with NORAD in the event of something like a hijacking over American airspace on the morning of 9/11. And they had the ability, at least theoretically, to do things like, say, put fake intercept, fake blips on radar screens and other such things. That was at least part of the capability of that software. And it was Michael Rupert's contention that it was Cheney that was really running that on the morning of 9/11. Now, of course, there is no hard evidence for that, but there's a lot of very, very interesting connections that can be documented. And I would suggest people start digging up things like that if they want to know a little bit more about the real story of Dick Cheney and why maybe even if you're a Democrat who's very excited about Harris, maybe you don't want to be courting an endorsement from someone like that.
Yeah. Now you mentioned Cheney and down there, there's Norman Mineta.
Yes.
Overheard some conversations with an officer and Cheney being definitely in charge of things. You know, we're not going to shoot anything down. Whether, you know, it's 20 miles out. He's 10 miles out. He's 5 miles. Do those orders still stand? And, you know, and I'll send people to your 9/11 page because you have all that stuff there. But
yes.
It's just like you hear that. And like I said, it's almost like the Kennedy assassination. If you were to hold up the bullet, Commission Exhibit 399, said all, there's no way. So here you look at Building 7. You go, there's no way. And then when you talk about these things that people would not believe, it also reminds me of another. It was somebody made a film. It's like a one-man show. I think it's called Who Killed John O'Neill? And it's about this one guy who puts on these different characters as the investigator, as the guy who's really conspiracy theory oriented, and the guy that's a little paranoid. And it was well done for the time, but I could never get an interview with the writer director and all that. Do you ever see that film?
I did, yes. I remember that from back in the day. And absolutely.
On that guy's wall was the famous little, you know, wire drawings and pointing here to here, crawling. All the people who were in charge of security and, you know, if anybody had to have someone to stand down, they could have. And like you say, it wouldn't be just one group. It's like people in Wall Street, the people who funded Pentagon, the people who they've decided that we need this and let's get this in action, right? And
exactly right, yeah. And yes, that was for its time. It was a very, very, I don't know what to call it. It wasn't a documentary, but it was certainly had real information about some of those interesting connections. And for people who don't know the reference, John O'Neill was an FBI investigator who was in charge of investigating the various Al-Qaeda, CIA provocations in the 1990s, who took a job to head security at the World Trade Center, who's, depending on which report you read, his first day on the job was supposedly 9/11/2001, and he ended up dying in the towers that day, which is an interesting story in and of itself. But if people really want to go down that rabbit hole of the FBI investigations and Al-Qaeda in the 1990s and its various attacks and what that story was really about, well, if you like my 5 minute, 9/11 in 5 minutes video, you're going to love my 5.5 hour Secret History of Al-Qaeda documentary. It's called False Flags. And in 5.5 hours, I go through the story of the creation of Al-Qaeda, where it comes from, what, you know, the various characters that populate it. Absolutely insane parts of the story, like Ali Mohammed, the triple agent, who was at the same time as he was working at for the Green Berets as a trainer, was also connected with Osama bin Laden's personal bodyguard, scouting out locations for various terror attacks, moving around the United States and around the world with complete impunity. Just crazy stories like this that are absolutely inexplicable from within the official story. Again, there's a lot of information in that documentary.
Yeah, and then something I just mentioned we didn't touch on, but we can't cover it all. Like you say, you have hours and hours of documentaries. Was that the money, the 2.7 trillions missing? And then on the stock market, they found out that people were putting put options. They were betting that something was going to happen, and then they ceased that investigation. It got shut down. And that was involving millions of dollars.
Yes, that's right. So for people who want the reference on that, they can go to my 9/11 Trillions documentary, where I talk about that SEC investigation at the time, the largest SEC investigation in history into the informed trading that demonstrably and categorically did take place before 9/11. And that's not my opinion. That is the conclusion of not one, not two, but three separate peer-reviewed papers that appeared in economics journals over the past couple of decades that have confirmed there was some sort of informed trading, or at least the evidence is consistent with informed trading that took place before. The SEC investigation ultimately got called off and got dismissed in the 9/11 Commission cover-up by saying, well, the people who were found to have placed those suspicious trades had no conceivable connection to Al-Qaeda and thus had nothing to do with 9/11, which, of course, absolutely begs the question. The aforementioned Kevin Ryan that I talked about before at Underwriters Laboratory, he did an excellent investigation on the documents that came out through the 9/11 Commission, the FBI interviews, etc., that showed that at least one of those people of interest was Wirt D. Walker III, who was a distant cousin or a distant relative of Bush, but also worked with Marvin Bush, the George Bush's brother, at Stratesec, which was a company that was involved with the various security systems that were operating at airports on 9/11 itself. Again, a whole other story there, but long story short, what did the SEC do with its records of this investigation? As I say, at the time, the biggest investigation in SEC history. They destroyed them, of course, as part of routine record keeping. So those documents have long been destroyed. But that's just one part of it. You also bring up the $2.3 trillion that at that time in 2001 was being admitted was unaccounted for in the Pentagon's books. It's not that it was missing. It's just that we don't quite understand. We can't track $2.3 trillion worth of transactions. This was a known phenomenon that was even discussed in Rumsfeld's Senate confirmation hearing in the early part of 2001. But it was September 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11, that Rumsfeld decided to hold a press conference to announce a new war, a war on bureaucracy, because we can't account for this $2.3 trillion. Our accounting systems are old and they're not talking to. We need a war on bureaucracy. That's what we need. And the money quote from that that I have in my 9/11 trillions documentary, when Rumsfeld got up the day before 9/11 and was talking about this and said, well, some people may ask how the Secretary of Defense can declare a war on the Pentagon, but here we are. And just absolute insanity like that. But anyway, that $2.3 trillion eventually became $8.5 trillion, eventually became $20 trillion. And as I've talked about with Catherine Austin Fitz and Mark Skidmore, I believe is his name. And anyway, people can look it up in my website. I've interviewed them about their investigation that show, essentially, we have absolutely no idea how much money is missing from the Pentagon's coffers at this point. It could be absolutely any amount, because they ultimately not only have never really passed an actual audit of the Pentagon for decades and decades, despite being congressionally obligated to do so, they have also made it retroactively legal for them to lie about their budgets in the name of national security. They can literally lie to the American public, and that's totally fine and legally defensible, according to them. So we have absolutely no idea how much money is missing or what those funds are being put towards. But there's just one interesting part of 9/11. Of course, that story, $2.3 trillion we can't account for, presumably would have been a pretty big story if it hadn't have been immediately suppressed the next day by the largest political event of this century.
Yeah. Well, you certainly have some of the great work on 9/11, and you must be able to be proud to tell people that they can find all your videos on YouTube.
Ha ha, yes, no.
What?
For people who do not know, no, I was censored from YouTube for wrongthink over the past few years for daring to talk about various aspects of the biosecurity complex and questioning, quote-unquote, the science. So, no, my channel got scrubbed back in 2021. Not only my main channel, but also my secondary backup channel. And then several months later, for no reason and with no warning whatsoever, suddenly my backup channel was back on YouTube, but my main channel continues to be censored. So, of course, I do not use YouTube at this point. And although some people have mirrored some of my videos, and I think there was a Corbett Report mirror channel on YouTube for some period of time, but you might be able to find it there. But please do not rely on YouTube for your viewing, because it is a censorship platform. They do censor important information. You will not find the full story at YouTube. So I am on many platforms, Rumble and Odyssey and BitChute and archive.org and Substack, etc. But probably the best place for people, if they are interested in my work, CorbettReport.com.
Right. And you can view videos there, and also you can download them. I see.
That's right. Yes. You can download directly from my server, which is important, because eventually, you know, all of these wonderful platforms, they're great for the time being, but who knows what will happen in the future, whether they start censoring or go out. So
I've heard so many people that say they saw something, then they went looking for it, and they can't find it anymore. They can't find it. And, you know,
the censorship on the search side is another thing altogether. For example, type 9/11 conspiracy theory, James Corbett, Corbett Report, whatever, into Google, and you will not find my original post of that. Of course you won't. And for many years, the censorship on the search side has been there. So it's getting harder and harder to find things online. That is why it is important for me to have my website at least as my last line of defense, until they start taking people's websites, which presumably will come in the future. But at least in the meantime, you can always download my work directly from my servers.
Yeah, congratulations for that, but you have them, because you are warning people, actually. You say, listen, this stuff will not be around. You've got to download them now, or join my, subscribe to my Corbett Report and get them there, because For sure, I'm gonna, this is gonna not go over well, and it didn't. I'm just...
just to clarify, you do not need to subscribe or pay me a penny or sign up or do anything in order to get any of my reports. They're all 100% for free. The subscription is really only if you support the work, if you like the work, if you want to see the work continue, and you don't get any special super insider access to exclusive information. It's really just if you want to support the work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just signed up. You can sign up with the bare minimum just to put your name in there and just let you know you support this kind of thing. And but yeah, that's a good note, because I didn't mention that, right? When I went into the searches, there's just so much stuff there. Well, you said like from 2007?
That's right.
So yeah. You have, and these are really worthwhile. They're not for the uninitiated in a way, you know. There was a fellow out of Toronto, you mentioned that one writer, but he did one of the first 9/11 videos that caught my eye, and it was like on a Sunday night show.
Mm.
I forget his name now, but...
I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Barry.
Barry. Can't think of his, but at least you got the Barry right.
Yeah.
And that was one of those things that said, wait a minute, really? It started questioning you. You go, you know, what? And it just started to show that there's, regardless of what happened, if you look at the government trying to pass off this cover story, it's so riddled with fraud, it should make you distrust the government. And then now, time after time, with even with the Canadian government, they want to initiate something, Bill 63, where C-63, if you, parrot a meme or this, it could be a $5,000 fine. It could be $20,000 fine. And the further one is that if you are promoting genocide, it's lifetime imprisonment. Now you could take someone's meme about something in Gaza, whatever, you just post that, and you look what's happening in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost happening so fast I can't keep up with what's happening in Australia. But at least there's a big backlash in Brazil where they're banning X, they're banning, Twitter, Elon Musk. And this is a freedom of speech, as we all know. It's supposed to be for uncomfortable, unpopular speech. The stuff that
exactly.
You say, I like Dave Chappelle, you don't have to worry about that. But the stuff, if you say, I'm not sure what they're doing in Palestine, but it looks like genocide to me, mm-hmm. when you're killing, mm-hmm. they're bombing hospitals, mm-hmm. and little kids. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't have to go into the whole debate about what started it, what's going on. You can just say, it looks to me like they're telling people to go to this one area and then they're bombing that area. Now, is that not genocide? So then you, but just that, just even talking about that could get you a lifetime, imprisonment. And look what happened to, what's his name, Medhurst in England, Richard Medhurst.
Mm-hmm.
He was arrested, and who was the other latest guy? I mean, it's starting to happen.
I'm losing track of all of the
Well, the Telegram. His name is Pavel, but I can't remember
Durov,
his name.
I believe. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
yes. There's no doubt that freedom of speech. I won't even say freedom of speech is under attack, because I think it's been under attack for a long time. But at least the pretense that we have free speech in the free and democratic West is certainly starting to fall. And that is a very, very, very worrying sign, because, of course, everything is predicated on freedom of speech. It's why, for example, the American Founding Fathers put it as the First Amendment, the first part of the Bill of Rights is free speech, because they knew that freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, freedom to speak openly, to say your mind, is absolutely the bedrock of anything resembling a republic. And without that, we have nothing. And unfortunately, Canadians have been used to that for a very long time, because they've never had that type of Bill of Rights and the enshrinement. I mean, the Canadian Charter of Human Rights is only as good as the paper it's written on, as we've seen in various times, of course, including over the past few years under the Trudeau regime. So, yes, it is under attack. It is a huge threat, and people should be concerned about it. And the most important, the most disappointing part of this is not that it is happening. I would expect oligarchs to act like oligarchs and try to cut out the tongues of people telling the truth, but that people would actively cheer that on, even if you disagree with me and everything that I say and everything that I believe. Great, wonderful. It is certainly your right as a free, individual, sovereign human being to disagree with me and to voice your own opinion. But that is the point. We get to voice our opinions in an open manner, to have that sort of open debate. That is the bedrock of anything resembling a society predicated on truth and justice. And if we lose that, we lose truth and justice.
Yeah, and that sounds like what Edward Snowden was trying to warn us about quite a while ago, that this is what they're planning. Well, Mr. Corbett, thank you very much for your time. I know we're running out of time now, and I want to make sure that we covered 9/11 again, another anniversary, and that you've done such good videos and discussions on it, you know, even today. I mean, so if you could, I'll send you an email. Can you just give me a note of maybe your top 5 or 10
sure.
videos that you
yeah.
have on 9/11? Yeah. And I can put that in the show.
I'll try to narrow it down to 10.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, just you mentioned a few, and I yeah. just didn't take notes of it right now. So I thought, well, you probably yeah. have them at your fingertips.
I can do that for
and
sure.
And then that way, when people read the show notes to the interview, they go, oh, I'm going to watch that. Click here, click there, and help yeah. get traffic to your site. And just congratulations on keeping up the good fight.
Yep. Well, thank you for having me on. Thank you for continuing to talk about these subjects, even in the face of the crackdown. It is important that we keep talking about it.
Yeah. All right, then. Thanks so much. And we'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another segment of Black Op Radio. We are speaking to Mr. Jeff Carter right now. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Len.
Glad to have you back on. We have an announcement that the documentary, Colonel Fletcher Prouty, which we've worked on and you've put together under your own company, is ready for the public. And I'm here to help publicize it as much as I can.
Well, fantastic. The film is called Fletcher Prouty's Cold War. It is now available on Vimeo On Demand, which is a fine streaming service. A great setup for independent filmmakers, and I'm very pleased that we've had the opportunity to get it on that service.
Right. I think I had you on a month or two ago, and we were just talking about it was in the works and final editing, but I believe you did a showing already, so it has premiered. It's going to start playing wherever we can get it. Do you want to just talk about that?
So the plan for the film is to have it streaming online, where people can rent it for a nominal fee. And also that will be supplemented by occasional public screenings. So we had one here in Victoria, British Columbia, first week of August. That was a fairly successful screening. Everyone really responded well to the film. Most people who were there were not really familiar with Fletcher and his career, perhaps outside of the JFK film, but they all really responded to the film, to the storytelling, and to the historical information which is presented in the film.
Yeah, the thing about Fletcher is he was so interesting. Once you started looking into his career, it was just, wow, really? And he was here and he was there. That's what I found very intriguing. And the fact, of course, he worked 9 years, he had a 23-year military career, but 9 years in the Department of Defense, like in the Pentagon, working for very, very big projects. And he was there. And well, I've said this many times, all the different people who talk about, well, I have this or I have that theory or John Newman says this. Fletcher was there and he kept paperwork with him when he retired. So he had documents like you wouldn't believe, and he could back everything up he talked about, and I never found him to be wrong. Now, it's not, look, I thought, well, how can he never be wrong about anything? But I just, every time I investigated something, go, he's right about that. He's right, and I should just, you know, think that, well, sometimes you get a guy like Bob McNamara writing, he's colorizing the story, you know. We didn't want people to know how bad it was. There was Vietnam or whatever, you know, they've got an axe to grind. With Fletcher, he just said, hey, this is what we were doing in my day, and I don't think the public knows too much about it. And when I was speaking to Oliver Stone about this, he participated in it. I said, you know, it reminds me of an early Edward Snowden, that back in, you know, when Fletcher was talking about what the CIA was really doing and people should be more aware of it. It's kind of like what Edward Snowden was saying, that the NSA is spying on people. They're a lot further ahead to, you know, people don't really have an idea, and they should have an idea just to start the debate, the debate about things. And I think that's what Fletcher's role was, and you've done a great job here organizing this. There's so many ways you could tell a story, but the most interesting thing is here's a man who was actually there, and you called it Fletcher Prouty's Cold War, because that's basically when it starts. at the end of World War II.
That's right. The film basically covers Prouty's career in the U.S. military, the people he met, the events he witnessed, and his observation on some of the larger trends that played out in those years. He was kind of on the ground floor of the Cold War by having been drafted into the Air Force and serving on duty in North Africa through the last couple of years of World War II. One of the things about the North Africa service is that the actual combat that was going on at that time was dampening down. The Germans had been kind of reduced to areas of Libya, and so when he got the job as a VIP pilot serving for the Air Force, it was going to bring him a lot of very interesting activities related to flying people around that weren't necessarily directly relevant to the warfare that was happening and kind of reducing in that area, but subsidiary events related to the bigger theme, the bigger picture of the war, but events that would become more important when the war was all finished. So he is calling it a kind of ground floor entry into these themes is not far off at all. So, like, one of the stories he tells is about taking a geological survey team into Saudi Arabia and visiting the area which would hold the giant oil fields of Saudi Arabia, and which really kicked off the relationship of the United States with the countries of the Middle East, which became a majorly important touchstone for decades to come after the end of that war.
Yeah, among so many stories. But, you know, that's that alone, you know, to find out he was the head of the Cairo airfield and then Tokyo, right? It's just so interesting. And of course, he had opinions on the JFK assassination, but there's so much more to, I think, listen to. And a few people have listened to, quite a few people, some of the videos that I already have. I have videos up on YouTube of various little interviews or small excerpts. And here's a really good chance to get a well-rounded overview of his whole career and early life. And then, you know, what makes him so interesting, that he was around interesting times and people. And I can't think of somebody else that wrote, you know, more just right from that point of view of just being there. Here are the facts.
Right. Know? Well, two other very important events he was witness to during that period of time as World War II sort of slowly went away, at least in the North Africa and related region. One was having a tangential connection to events around the Tehran conference in December of 1943. He flew a group of VIPs into the city of Tehran to attend that conference, and he picked up the vibes from that about sort of major political decisions being made by the Allied powers, represented at that conference by FDR, Stalin, and Churchill, to enter a post-war world where the colonial system, which had existed for a few hundred years up to that point, would be essentially ended. That was going to be a major event. He also personally witnessed an event that was related to the quiet rehabilitation of Nazis into the U.S. security structures. And that program was assisted by key figures in the American organization, the OSS. So that also was kind of an important thing to witness, because he could see with his own eyes that some of the decisions that were being made by the very heads of the Allied powers were being resisted or subverted in some ways by people a little lower down in the power structure. And this type of deceitfulness, I think, was something he had picked up on rather early in that game, and could quietly observe those type of activities as his career progressed.
Yeah, there's several anecdotes, about that kind of topic, where he's, briefing other generals, and you can tell they don't know that some operations are going on, you know. And I don't want to give away too much. It's so interesting. But, these briefings are, when I asked for 10,000 rifles, what happened to them,
Right. Yes.
All right. So this has taken a couple of years to put together, I guess. We've been sitting on the project, I guess, since we met on 2013 or 2012, even, when we decided to make 50 Reasons for 50 Years. And that is still going strong. I noticed that the numbers are still going up, which is encouraging. I don't know if I was talking to you about this or mentioned, but it kind of stands the test of time that there are many documentaries on JFK, but these five-minute snippets are just right-to-the-point comments about, the gun, the parade route, the assassin, the bullet, the route. I think they were just, it's really stands the test of time, and I mean, I haven't had any criticism that is got any merit to it. Whereas we've seen a few documentaries and films that say, oh, they got this wrong or they got that wrong, So I'm pretty proud of that.
It was very successful, and we formatted it to kind of fit into the online YouTube environment, and it allows...
Yeah, isn't that funny? We had an episode or two banned by YouTube. I had to post them somewhere else, and then you said about a year later, miraculously, they came back to life and the link worked again.
One of them came back, and that was the Oliver Stone episode where we dissected that terrible ABC television documentary that was produced, I believe, for the 40th anniversary of the assassination. Yeah, it was offline, and there was a copyright strike. And then it just came back on. They may have revived. I don't know what happened there, but it just came back on. The other one that I've noticed got taken down was the one with Richard Belzer, discussing mysterious deaths. And I believe the reason that got taken down was we have a few very graphic photographs of the deceased George de Morenschild. And YouTube, a couple of years ago, got a little sensitive to graphic content. And so I think that's what happened there.
Good Lord. Just the poverty of truth and the way it's under attack these days,
Well,
here's a photo. For instance, let's say you're looking at Bonnie and Clyde or something like that, and they show the car and the blood and, that's what happened. That's what happened. Or if they show any other accident or something, that monk that doused himself with gasoline?
Yeah.
That photo is... bad, and you have to click, view image, it's like, that's what happened. And that's uncomfortable. And somebody gave up his life for that. And for you just to pretend we don't want little children to see this.
Right. It does seem a little excessive. However, YouTube is an environment that isn't really subject to classification the way motion pictures are. So there's no PG rating or R rating or anything like that. So they need to.
They don't need
a rating.
I guess
they reached the decision that they needed to police their content little more.
Police.
And it's kind of a zero tolerance framework, in that if it's too graphic, then it goes, and it doesn't matter necessarily what context it is appearing in.
Yeah, I know. I think it came to my attention because it was also the cover of a Rage Against the Machine album.
Okay.
And then it was being banned, and you know, like, or you know, restricted. And
sure.
Somebody said, "Look at this, right? Because you can't, right?" And that's what gets me, right? With all the fraud of, well, there's just so much fraud, right?
Right.
Especially with the way they have attacked COVID-19, doctors talking about it, doctors talking, for instance, about ivermectin. And, you know, totally different topic, but, you know, thank goodness for Joe Rogan going on and saying, no, I was prescribed this, and I, you know, and there should just be, I don't know, no censorship. Just, it shouldn't be censored. It should be, here's, I can change the channel or I can turn it off if I don't like what the guy's saying, you know? So.
I would totally agree with that. I think the free expression of opinions, particularly controversial opinions, is important for the free flow of information and the creation of an informed citizenry by which democracies function.
Yeah, and you know that these topics you're not going to accidentally fall into. Like, for instance, if you turn on the Alex Jones channel and you start watching, you have an idea what you're going to be seeing or hearing. I mean, you have, so it's not like somebody is like, oh my God, I can't believe he said this or he said that. You know, like, you tuned into it, right? So if you're tuning into the National Geographic channel and you see a lion attacking a giraffe and chomping, I mean, you got to know that's what you're going to see, and that's, you know, what real life is, and not, oh, this will affect our young viewers and we can't show this, and we, you know, anyway, different topic. Back to Fletcher, let me ask you, was there one motivating factor that got you to say we've got to start this documentary? Because I know we just talked about it and you think I would have started it, but it was almost, I don't know where to start. I know too much about the guy, and anytime I started having an idea what how it could start, it just never happened, and you got it going.
Well, it was the unique situation that you were in the sense that you became, in effect, the custodian of some of his archives. So you had that material on hand.
So just bumping into me then, and it aroused your interest. Who the hell was Fletcher?
Oh, yeah. No, if we hadn't done the 50 reasons, I don't think anything like that would have, this project wouldn't have occurred. Yeah. Okay. So there was that first. The other thing, of course, if Black Op Radio didn't exist, I would never have heard the shows that led me to contact you in the first place. And so the 50 reasons wouldn't have existed. And if I'm correct, Glenn, Black Op Radio would not have existed if you had not befriended Fletcher some years before that.
Yeah, I remember when I ended up producing a CD-ROM of all his stuff because he had so much other stuff other than just the JFK assassination. I thought, I've got to put this together. And then we started doing radio shows. And I would come on to talk about his website and the CD-ROM and those kind of questions that he couldn't answer. And then he, you know, I came on at the end of the interview. But I was just appalled on how many radio shows had no idea about, really, they hadn't done the research just to, they heard that he was the Man X in the movie JFK. Oh, let's get him on and talk to him. And then they had no idea about the topic. So when I was talking to Anita, I said, you know, we could do a better job than these clowns, right? And so I said, let's do a show, let's do it. And we planned 4 or 10 shows, and now it's years later. Good Lord, a quarter of a century.
Yes. Absolutely, a groundbreaking podcast in many ways. I mean, you were on that very early.
Oh yeah, yeah. I shudder to think how early it was. But anyway, let's just talk about the documentary. We have good things to say about Fletcher, and the work is unparalleled of his writing and articles that he wrote on many topics, you know, which you'll find out. But I'm just so glad that something like this got off the ground. And
Long haul, as well as the photographic and document archival collection that you had, you also basically were custodian of those video interviews that were done in the early 90s, John Judge and David Ratcliffe and others interviewing Fletcher. And that became kind of the base material to work with. And that was a bit of a chore working through that. But as I sat down to watch them for the first time after thinking that this should become a documentary film, I thought what needed to happen is to work with this material, kind of melt it down, so to speak. So the bulk of the film is Fletcher discussing his personal experiences in his own words. And so that became really the bulk of the work involved, was just cutting through those things, segmenting the different topics, and then lining up the individual interviews discussing those specific individual topics, and then kind of melting them down so, you know, the best parts can be strung together in a clear line of thinking. What assisted that is, I believe, the content of these interviews matches in significant ways the content of Fletcher's own professional speaking engagements, which he was involved in the late 80s and early 90s. So he already had a kind of set speech. It would be restated in various ways, but there was that through line, and that through line is kind of consistent in those interviews. But it did take many hours of persistent chopping away to make those things flow.
Yeah, and I don't think many of these got onto the documentary, but you've heard a few of them. He had a lot of other radio shows that he had done early on. Carl Loren Live, I think, out of Los Angeles, and a lot of these radio shows that I had on cassettes, and I was able to digitize and send you MP3s of that. You kind of got to hear when he would be asked a question from different angles. You kind of know, okay, I've heard that before, but, you know, for me, the Dave Ratcliffe is my
favorite. Detail of subtype that you haven't heard before. And it's just like, oh, that's really interesting. Or that paints a picture that helps me understand, you know, what's happening here.
Like when somebody says, oh, by the way, did you know that when I was here, you know, Churchill was there too, and he was in a jumpsuit, and he didn't have any ID on him at all. And they wouldn't let him in.
Yeah, that was funny. And that happened at the Tehran Conference. The other detail that I found fascinating about the Tehran Conference was he described the security zone where the leaders were going to meet. And the Russians were in charge of the security. They set up basically a 10 or 15 foot high curtain. Fletcher called it a purple curtain that went around the entire zone, the inner zone of the city. And then Russian soldiers were spaced out all around that entire curtain. So no one could get in without they would have been seen and taken care of. So it was quite secure, but it was kind of an ingenious little system. And I searched for some kind of visual representation of that. It must be, I think, in some archives in Iran. You could probably dig it out, but I just did not have the resources to dig that deeply. But I found it a fascinating little detail. Nothing crucial about it, but still a detail that you would only get from someone who actually witnessed that for himself.
All right. So the video is out and available for a rental, 2-day rental, or whatever it is, the typical thing online. I'll make a link to the Vimeo address, and you're going to start showing the film around various venues. So keep in touch at Black Op Radio, and we'll try to keep you up to date if it's in some film festival. Do let me know. I'll let others know coming up in the fall. It should be playing in a few places. But that's good, and it's just so we've talked about this before, and people said it'd be good to see a real documentary about, you know, Fletcher, and give a little more background. And then if you want more background, you can go to Prouty.org and read and dig through stuff. And of course, there's a CD-ROM for download as well.
That's right, and I think it would certainly complement all that material. And I think the film also complements other similar, more kind of expansive discussions of the Cold War era. And I would think in particular, Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States is certainly a project with which this complements.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And we should mention that Oliver did take part in this, so... there's footage of him discussing Fletcher Prouty and his contributions to the JFK film, and then just his, you know, personal thoughts.
Yes, that was a very good interview, and it definitely helped tell the story. As we also include an interview with yourself that also helps tell the story in great ways. And so I hope people, if you're interested, please see the film. Let us know what you think. If you enjoy it, please recommend it to a friend or two.
Right. Okay, Mr. Carter, it's always good doing work with you. Thank you for taking time to talk today about the film. And I'm just so happy that we can announce that it's available for people. And we'll leave it there for now. Anything else before I wrap up that you wanted to add?
No, this is all great, Len.
All right. We'll keep in touch, and thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good night.